from Portland, Oregon, and I work half-time as a parish pastor of a church that's half Lutheran and half Roman Catholic. We always add because it's a rather unique situation. And I'm also a clinical social worker in private practice. And really look at how to put both what I work with in terms of social work counseling and how to live life, and what we can also learn from our faith and how to live life. And that's kind of where I come from.
I'm Ricky Chamfer, and Dale's doing all the work this week. I'm just sitting back and writing things up on the board and so forth. At home in Portland, I'm a high school teacher at Lutheran High School, Portland Lutheran High School. I teach geography and history, and I'm a college counselor there. And we have worked together on a lot of small groups over the years. But there's so much on, so many people in the faculty this week, so many offerings that they've cut down our sessions, which is fine. We get to hike more. And so I'm assisting today and this week.
I'm surprised she even came. I thought she'd be at Martin Murray.
I didn't know if anybody else would be here.
Well, I do appreciate you being here and your interest in the topic. I sometimes get going in terms of being excited about what I'm explaining and sharing. And if you want to raise a question or say why or, you know, something like that, just come right ahead and jump in, because I welcome that kind of feedback. Peace as the Key to Health and Vitality is our title for today. And let me just ask you, when you think of the peace of Christ, when Christ says, "My peace I give to you, not as the world gives, and that I sent the Spirit that you may have peace," what is that? What kinds of images come to mind? What do you think of?
I think of peace as like the passing of a storm. Everything is clear and clean and refreshed, and it's just the opposite of what it was before.
Okay.
Great image.
I think of warmth and kind of a contented feeling.
Warmth and connected.
Contented.
Well, contented.
Contentment.
I feel like a real joyful connectedness, which I felt this morning when I was hiking out on the trail there, and I ran into a couple of deer, a buck and a doe were walking beside me. And I just, as I came back, I was by myself, I was trying to catch up to these hikers, and they didn't come until later. I thought I was behind them. I just was there all by myself, and I just kind of, you know, go like this, and you just feel connected to everything, and the mountains were in the distance, and it's just it's peace, but it's real joyful and connected with everything around you.
Okay.
I think of images like that too, but especially water, lake, or that's an image.
You're about ready to share something with us? Someone else before you ready?
I think of peace of when you're doing something that feels right, like you're have found a calling or vocation, and it feels right, and things seem to fall into place. I've experienced that.
Okay.
It feels good. It feels peaceful.
Kind of a congruity.
Yeah.
My biggest problem would be making a decision, and until I find the answer to my problem, I'm uneasy.
Okay.
And as soon as I find the solution, then I have that inner peace that I made the right decision.
Okay.
Like I was fortunate in finding a large bill of money, and I was trying to decide what to do, and I was so confused. would be doing the right thing. And then when I finally did solve my problem, I had that inner peace.
Okay. Would you share?
Peace like progress.
Peace like progress. Progress like a running river, yeah.
It's like
okay.
A river.
It's moving, it's flowing. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's shift now. What's the opposite of peace?
Stress, chaos.
Frustration.
Turmoil.
Confusion.
Turmoil. Anxiety.
Pressure.
Fear.
Anger. No.
Uncontrollable.
Situation. There's a lot of turmoil kinds of things.
Yeah. Probably something what's the opposite of peace.
That one's easy.
Being lost.
I think in that, in terms of the opposite of peace. Is
traveling.
Anxiety.
Planes late.
Your wife's late.
Well, that's, you get used to that after 35 years.
I asked a group of pastors that, and one of the things they came up with was battling with oneself.
That's a good one, man.
That we are in a struggle with who I am, and am I enough, and what I should be, and how I should be, and all of that kind of stuff within us. And I think that gets at what I think is one of the basic...
Mixed up.
Yeah. Okay. Mixed up about who I am. And because if we are somehow at peace with who we are, being at peace with the world follows. Whereas if we're in a battle with ourselves, we keep trying to get the world to solve our inner battle. And so we're frustrated with everything in the world because the world just doesn't seem to help us answer those deeper questions within us. And once in a while it feels good, as you say, when something clicks and everything feels right, and you could say, wow, I must be okay, because everything's working. But so often, nothing's quite working well enough for me to feel really good. So, one of my concerns then is if peace is at the base, being at peace with who I am, then I need to answer the question, who am I? And how we answer that question can often lead us to where we look for peace. If I am a machine, a body, and I get my identity from what I can do, I am somebody because I'm able to do things, then as long as I can get this body to work well and get my mind to work well, then I think maybe I've answered my question of who am I. If I get my sense of worth from how you think about me, how other people think about me, how they feel about me, and then when my relationships are working well, then I can kind of say, ah. But as soon as someone frowns, then I go, oops. Or if I get my worth from having control and power over things in life, possessions and positions of power, and when they work well, then I can feel okay. And so I may seek my peace in those things. Thank you. Now, if who I am is that I am a person created in the image of God, then I may need to seek that peace in my relationship with God. And I think that's going to be the answer for us. What I did, I struggled with this question, who am I? And one of my concerns is that we have bought into the biological or the medical model in some ways, the sensing that the body is like a machine and that I am a body. And what that does then is tend to say that I am here, and if God is the Father or the Son or the Holy Spirit, that God is there. And I kind of have a relationship between who I am and what God is. And my concern with that is that we end up sensing that we are an entity that is independent, that we can be who we are, and we can kind of choose whether we want a relationship with God or not. It's like, well, should I believe in God or not, or should there be a God or not, or, you know, with that kind of a framework, we feel one, we feel a separation, and it tends to shape the way we relate to God. So often our prayers then is, God, do you want to come to me? God, do you, when we pray for something, it's like we're thinking maybe God is going to enter into the creative process and make something happen. And oftentimes we call that a miracle. And so often we pray in such a way that we think that if God is going to answer our prayer, he's going to have to answer it with a miracle. And we say, well, you know, what are the chances of God wanting to do a miracle right now? And we tend, I think, to be pretty hesitant about believing that God is actually going to do a miracle. So oftentimes as we pray for healing, we don't expect much. That's one of my concerns, and that concern grows out of a sense that in the Lutheran Church, we have some real, we've downplayed the idea of our faith and our prayers having a lot to do with healing. Now, we do pray for it, but our expectation level is pretty low. I mean, you really do the medical thing, and then, you know, it's nice to add a prayer on top of that, just in case. Okay? Now, that may not have been your experience, and I'm happy when it isn't, but in a general way, I sense that it is. Jesus seems to be excited in challenging some of that, and he talks about receiving God into our lives. He talks about the importance of being receptive. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. He says, if your eye is sound, your whole body will become full of light, and you'll become bright as a lamp. He said, I am the light, you become the light. And he talks about it not just in terms of light as knowledge, but in terms of being filled with the light. He even goes up on the Mount of Transfiguration and shows us what that's like. I think he's trying to say, you know, this light is real. The light of God, my light, is present, has come into the world, and it casts out darkness in us. And then he talks about God as love, and he talks about abiding in God's love, sensing the presence of God's love, that God's love is not just that God loves from over there, but that God's, notice, abide in. It's like a pillow or like a blanket that you kind of snuggle up in. And so I believe that God is present. And I drew a picture. And for you to understand what I'm going to be saying about peace, I almost need to show you the picture, because it creates some paradigms. Ah. Now, one of the things that started me along this line is quantum physics. Quantum physics is saying that everything is a happening. No longer is there an it, but that we are made up of particles of energy. And one of the images I've had of that is a 4th of July when you see the fireworks go off. And when they try to look at the particles, it's like looking at the spots of light, the specks of light from a fireworks. It's like the light go. And that's all we see when we look at the particles. And I read that one of the particles, and just to give you an idea, is called a boson, and that a boson is a momentary burst of energy that lasts a millionth of a millionth of a millionth of a second. And that things are made up of these bursts of energy. So I got to thinking, maybe physics is saying we are, we're made up of bursts of energy. We're a dynamic happening. And I thought, now that's helpful. Because it was awfully hard when I thought of myself as a machine to think of how faith would really affect this machine that much. What impact could faith have on a machine? Now, certainly all things are possible with God, but my mental framework made it hard to conceive of how that could even happen. But when I begin to realize that I'm just happening all the time, and that thought is an electrochemical event, or at least part of thought is an electrochemical event, that it affects my whole body. Every thought you have has an electrochemical event in the body. We've also discovered that the same chemicals that are in the brain are in every cell of your body. So you think with your whole body. You know, when you say, it feels to me like that, I know it in my gut, there's some reality to that now. And the discoveries are beginning to raise all kinds of questions of this thought or intelligence. Is it only in the cells, or does it exist somehow between the cells? And I'm just reading a book, Ageless Body, Timeless Mind. It just is fascinating with all kinds of... his whole thesis in this is that a lot of our aging is what we think. And one of the experiments he tells about, I'm going to run out of time if I tell all these, but it's like, I can't wait. and at least most of you haven't been to the other sessions. So.
Sherry may be finding some of this duplication.
No, it's fine.
Anyway, there's a, what do I want to say?
Study done with older people?
What's the lie detector machine?
Oh,
polygraph machine. That was, okay. There was a guy who worked with polygraph machines and did research. And what he found, of course, not only in terms of lying, but in terms of any kind of a stimulus. If he showed people an erotic picture, or if he did show them things that recalled traumatic experiences, they would have a response on the polygraph machine. And so he then set up some experiments where he would take a scraping of the cells from their mouth and take those cells and put them in the next room and hook it up to a polygraph machine. And then he would show them things that would cause a reaction on the polygraph machine. And what he found was that when they reacted, the cells from their mouth in the next room also reacted. And then he gives you one of these zingers. He had a World War II veteran who was a pilot, and when he would show him films of planes being shot down, he had a real strong reaction on the polygraph. He had taken his cells from his mouth, just a few cells scraped from his mouth, and had them 7 miles away, had a polygraph machine set up and had a video camera on the polygraph machine so that he could watch on a screen where he was. and he found that there was a reaction 7 miles away when this fellow was watching a movie and reacted to the movie. So what's happening now is research is raising all kinds of questions of the interaction of our mind, thought, and energy. So this is just saying that what it means to be in the image of God is to be a manifestation of God's light, God's spirit, and God's love. That creation is happening right now. That creation is always, these bursts of energy are always being informed with purpose. And so that creation is ongoing, and that we are a manifestation of God's light, love, and spirit. And certainly that's kind of what we saw when Jesus went up on the mountain. You know, why did he go up on the Mount of Transfiguration and show us those things? Now, there's a lot we could talk about just in that, but I wanted this only as background, because notice that who I am is no longer an it who is here and God is over there. I am who I am by every moment, the grace of God. Jesus said, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. That I live every moment, every breath, every burst of energy of my presence is informed by God. And so then I begin to say that relationship with God must be pretty critical. That by faith I tune in and I receive all that God is trying to give me. If I don't have faith, if I block what God is trying to give me, I begin to deaden myself. And so Jesus talks about, I came that you might be alive, fully alive. And he talks about that we create a deadness and that the need to move from deadness to life. So faith, I believe, is a way of receiving what God is trying to give us. Now, what becomes the problem? What problem? Jesus wraps up right near the end of the Sermon on the Mount by saying, don't be like the foolish man who builds his house on the sand. And the winds come and the waters come and wash away the foundation. Be like the wise man who builds his house on the rock. And so I raise the question, what does it mean that we build our house? What do we build our house on? And I believe that we find the answer to that in the temptations of Jesus. Do you remember what the first word was when Jesus was tempted? It's a two-letter word. Great big one. If you are the Son of God, doubt it. Be afraid that it's not true. Don't trust it. The beginning of sin is to be afraid that I'm nobody. That's the basic temptation. It is to be afraid that I'm nobody, that I'm not enough. And when that becomes what we build our life on, if we start out with that fear and anxiety that is in all of us, we all have that fear, that anxiety. And then what we do is try to build a house. And the devil offers us three ways. He says, all you need to do, Jesus, to be somebody, one is turn stones into bread. Know that you're somebody by what you do. jump off the pinnacle and get God to send his angels to take care of you. Know that you're somebody by what other people think of you. If you can get people to care for you, like you, etc., affirm you, then you can feel good about being who you are. And the third one, Jesus, look at all the lands of the earth. I will give you dominion over all the lands of the earth. You'll just bow down to me. You will know you're somebody by all the things that you control, your positions of power and possessions. So when we start with a fear of being nobody and build our house, who we are, based on one of those three or combinations of those three ministers, what we have is a house that is always shaky. Then we need to be afraid of everything. And this is what stress is about. We need to be afraid if I know that I'm somebody because I can play golf or do something, then every time I miss a ball, it's gone. Every time what I do doesn't quite work, it's not enough. And the truth of this is that they're never enough, that we're always threatened in some way. So what I have to do is I strain myself to try to make sure I'm enough. I try to make myself strong. I try to make myself be enough. And that's one of the non-peace parts, where we attempt somehow to make ourselves be enough. And it's that stress then that ultimately creates most of our basic illnesses, especially the popular ones of cancer and heart attacks, but many of the others. When we look deep down at the basis, it's when we have done, by straining and stressing, that we overload or underload different parts of our body, put a strain on them, and affect them. And this is done, you know, in such a dynamic way, we don't understand all of it. So we don't understand the relation of this to illness that well. But I believe deep down, it's how we deaden ourselves. Now, secondly, we put then being at peace, or not being at peace, is being at odds with other people. And when I need to get other people to make me feel good, then I'm always wanting something more than they seem to be giving me. And I always need to manipulate people. And so I break relationships because I keep wanting or needing them to be more than they are. And I can't love them in that state because I need them to be the way I need them to be. Because, again, I'm dependent on their affirmation for me to feel like I'm somebody. And then the third one is that I hang on to things or power, possessions, positions. It's like I need to have those to feel like I'm somebody. Often at a time of retirement, people feel really threatened. Who am I going to be if I'm not that particular job or that particular position? It's very threatening to us. And it's been found that positions of underload, jobs of underload, are even more stressful than jobs of overload. Now that's interesting, huh? Not having enough to do is so anxiety provoking, because how do I know that I'm somebody if I don't have enough to do? So we hang on to things, we overstrain ourselves, and we manipulate or are threatened by people. Those are three then of the basic evidences of the lack of peace in our lives, and they grow out of how we build our house on fear. The alternative then is to build our house on faith, to trust that who I am by the grace of God is enough. God has made me who I am. I can rest and trust that and live out life. I do what I do then not in order to become somebody, but because I am somebody by the grace of God. Now, how to move from fear to faith is one of the real challenges of how to know peace. Why do you think Jesus needed to die? propose that the reason Jesus needed to die was because we are so afraid of losing things. We're so afraid of letting go. That we want to live by faith, but after all, this job or this car or this person that loves me and so forth, I would hate to let go of them and because I'm not that sure of faith. So we have difficulty letting go of the things that we have that give us our sense of worth. And so what I think Jesus going to the cross is about is that he is going, he's saying, come with me, we're going to go towards what you fear the most. We're going to go towards that fear that is tying you up in knots. Come on. And he takes us and he says, I'm going to lose all my physical powers. They're going to drain the blood from me. You know, I'm going to have no physical capacity. Come on with me. They're going to totally reject me. They're going to mock me. You know, what we fear most, being ridiculed and mocked and spit upon. So he says, come on. I'm going to go into that fear. And then he says, you know, come on, we could lose everything. And they cast lots for his garment, and he loses his very life. So he's saying, you can lose it all. You can have nothing that you think is important or that gives you your sense of worth. And yet you can have that deep sense of worth. Because I live, you too shall live. You are somebody by the grace of God. God is doing this because God loves you, affirms you, and comes to you and wants to fill you with life. So relax. Be at peace. Open up and let yourself be filled. Let go of all the things that you're hanging on to. And I will fill you. And you will be free. Okay. Any questions on that before we move on to experiment with that?
Is this more like blind faith? What they would call it, blind faith? Where you just, like, something doesn't feel peaceful to you, that you get rid of it? Or,
well,
sure.
Okay.
Just kind of faith that was not peaceful, so you remove the non-peaceful thing?
What I think confession is about is getting a hold of what kind of a house have I built? Mm-hmm. What am I hanging on to? Mm-hmm. How am I straining myself? Mm-hmm. That when we become aware of how I'm trying to make it all happen. That confession is saying, Lord, I don't really seem to trust you. I'm trying to make it happen myself in some way. And it's a heavy, it's not working very well. Or sometimes to confess it's working too well. Jesus says it's harder for the rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven than for the camel to pass through the eye of a needle, because I believe the rich man's life is successful. And he can say, you know, gee, I'm really great. I'm somebody because everything I've done works and I've made money and I've got everything. And, you know, how can one get in touch that he really needs God when he has all that success going? Mm-hmm. I think that's what Jesus meant when he said, he who finds his life will lose it. If there's somebody we create works too well, we begin to believe in it. And we don't realize that we need to open up to God. And ultimately, whatever image we've created becomes a prison.
Do you have an example from yours and Ricky's life of like a time where you felt this? Like,
okay.
So it appears to be around decision-making. Do you have when you...
I can give what I wanted to move on to and nice lead in.
One of the images that comes to my mind is the life of Howard Hughes, who was a tremendously successful inventor, producer, all sorts of things, but that was his successful life. He was a mover and a shaker. As he began to hold on to that, what he had, he became more and more fearful, until finally he became a complete recluse, because he was so afraid he'd lose everything that he had. He had no faith in anything but himself, not any of the people around him, and nothing. So he tried desperately to hold on to everything that he had, and that he had done.
You know, I understand what you're saying, and I can see how we buy into all that stuff, and yet, you know, we're human, and we hang on to things, and it's a human thing to do that. The only thing is, I have one objection, is that for people who get heart attacks or cancer, I don't believe that it's necessarily because of something they did or didn't do. I think that could be explained often by heredity. It's just a condition that you are born with. You know, I kind of, you know, to blame the victim for an illness, it just, I don't like that. And it doesn't ring true to me. I can understand what you're kind of saying, because you can make yourself ill, and I've always thought that. But I really don't believe, because I've gone through that, and I don't feel that it's something that I did. Even though I fall into many of the things you said, of course, you know, I'm human, and all those things that you said, you know, lack of faith and fear and all those things. I mean, if we didn't have them, we'd be paragons of whatever. You know, so I understand what you're saying. I'm not objecting to that, but that part about the illness, I don't...
Okay.
I have two things I wanted to share. I know it wasn't arguing with your why Jesus died, but I think that the history, of course, they said that in the Bible, they said that there would be a coming and he would die. Death was a fearful thing to a lot of people at that time. I think one of the reasons, or I think that one of the reasons why he died was to show that it was not a bad thing. And he did, Christ went into death very positive and never fearing. And he had a lot of faith. And then the other thing I wanted to share, that wasn't that important anyway, but you're making my point. The other thing is that about over 20 years ago, I went into a little program called Silva Mind Control. It was one of those way out things, maybe, I don't know. I felt real good with it. But relaxing was one of the big things that they tried to teach you. And I experienced quite a bit the relaxation of where I would completely go out of my body, and it was a very peaceful experience, by the way. And that's one of the reasons why I did it, to get some peace. But the thing of it is that me and my body are really two different things, in essence, that I found out. And I felt as though within me, right with me, one part of it is God, whatever he or she may be, or whatever it is. And that when I left my body this way, I was similar to God. I don't want to say equal, but I don't know what other words to use, because in the of what I experienced.
Okay. That who you are is apart from your body, and yet
physically, yeah,
and connected.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really concerned that when I say this, that in response to you, Doris, that people would hear that as saying, therefore, I did something to create my illness. This is far more generic than that. That I believe, for instance, a lot of our aging is based on our belief system. A lot of the whole way our bodies function is based on our belief system. And that all of us live out this this fear. And it affects us all in different ways. And so it's not that the person who gets sick has less faith than another person. It's that all of us have a lack of faith that really lets us receive all that Christ, I think, is trying to give us. And that all we can know is that we can just try to open up to God's blessing. And so it's far more dynamic than... See, I think faith may be related to illnesses that may develop from the third and fourth generation, that somehow it's not that one person sinned a sin, but that these things are cumulative also through our genetics in ways we don't fully understand. So I want to create a framework that gives us a way of opening up to healing and to life. And not to say that the person with any particular illness is therefore to blame as different from any other condition.
Well, so much of life is chance. I mean, if I was in the wrong place at the wrong time and there was radiation there and I didn't know it and I was a little kid, for instance, you know, that's not something, that's what I'm talking about. There's so much chance type of stuff that goes into our bodies that we're not even aware of. I mean, even our coming together is complete chance. I mean, the fact that I was born to my mother and dad was like, it's, you know, you can look at it later on and say, yeah, maybe there was a plan there, but it's so much as chance.
That's right. It's far more dynamic than a cause and effect. I did this, and therefore I got this. Now, let me get to how some of this works. And we all become afraid as kids. And as I counsel with people, I find deep down that all of us have some anxieties about who we are. And we try to work them out through our lives. But some people I talk to get a sense of...
Throw that one. You never deal with it. That doesn't work. Dale, would you erase your name on the other side of the full board there? See, this is my role.
School teacher coming up.
These are nonverbal messages usually that children get, but they get the feeling from parents or other significant people in their lives, somehow I shouldn't exist. Life would be better if I wasn't here. Somehow I shouldn't be who I am. To you, I'm a boy, I should have been a girl, or I should have been a boy, or there's something about me. I'm too this or that, too small, too big, too something. Don't be belong. Somehow I don't belong to this family. Children often ask their parents, was I adopted? They got the feeling that somehow they were not really a part of the family. Don't be close. Somehow others are close, but somehow for me I shouldn't be close. Don't be important. If I'm too important, then dad will be threatened or something. Don't be a child. Act like an adult right away. And
don't grow up.
This might be where mother has so much invested. Her identity is being mother. And for her to be mother, she needs to have the child to be child. And therefore, don't think for yourself. Don't feel for yourself. I will think for you. I will help you. I will rescue you. I will take care of you. And you just be a little child and don't grow up. Or sometimes for a girl, it's like dad gets uncomfortable. Don't grow up over 10. I don't want you to become a young woman because then I don't know what to do with you. And so don't grow up and be a woman. And then Johnny, go out and find Susie, whatever she's doing, tell her don't. Yeah, just the feeling that. So these fears get communicated through the family dynamics. Usually we're not as parents ever aware that we're doing it. It comes out of our own anxieties. It's certainly often not the message we want to send to a child. But we do in different ways. And then out of this fear, I'm not enough, something's wrong with me, comes the struggle, well then what do I have to be? And then we hear messages like this. These are some that have come. If you would just be perfect. So we have a child who gets, you know, four A's and a B and says, woe is me, I got a B. Whatever I do is never quite enough. It never quite meets the standard. But if I could just do it all right, then I would be enough. And this person goes on and really strains and strives to be perfect. One I knew was hurry up. I never did things fast enough. And this was communicated in one way. My dad was always hurrying to do whatever he did. And one image I have is dad running to mow the lawn. So it was always hurry, hurry, hurry. Another one you might recognize is try harder. You're not trying hard enough. And the child gets the feeling, no matter how hard I've tried, I haven't tried hard enough. And I have to keep, and you may know people like that. And you may know it yourself, that when you do things, it feels like things are hard. Or you talk to some people and say, oh, man, I really tried hard. And what this person often does is they get into trying hard but not doing. So whatever they're doing feels hard. They're always exhausted. Be strong. Or for girls, sometimes it'd be attractive. It's, you know, be cool. Don't let anybody know you have any weaknesses. Don't cry. Don't look upset. Don't do anything. Just always look like you've got it all together. So the person tries to cover up any show of weaknesses and kind of holds themselves just so, just right. Another one is, please me, says mother or dad, or please others. And this person grows up and says, if I just please people enough, then I'll be somebody. And if someone frowns, I get anxious and say, oops, what did I do? What do I have to do to make people happy? And this person just keeps their antenna up and often is very out of touch of what they want or what they need in life. They're so caught up in the need to please others. And to give you the example of how I experience it myself, our family was very involved in church, and whenever we'd come home from church on Sunday morning, we would spend time saying, how could things have been done better and what can we do about it? I felt that we were responsible for making things go better. And so I got the idea, if you're just responsible enough for everything, then you'll be somebody. So I go on, I become a social worker, and I become a pastor, and I take care of people, and if I meet you, I'd have to find out what your problem was so I could take, you know, be responsible. And notice, people looking at me would say, gee, how nice, how virtuous. Look at how much he cares about people. He goes out of his way to take care of, he's so concerned about people's problems. What I came to realize was the very essence of that was my sin. Even though it looked so good, because I was doing it to try to make myself somebody. Now, what happened? It felt like I had hat pins in my shoulder blades because I was holding myself, trying to make sure everything, being responsible for everything. You know, sometimes say carrying the weight of the world on your shoulders. It has a body component to it. At the end of the day, I could be just totally fatigued because I was trying so hard to make it all come out okay. Make it all happen. Secondly, then I couldn't love you because I'd have to use you. I'd have to find out your problems so I could solve it, so I could feel good about being me. So it was a manipulation, it wasn't love. And often that would really affect the way I would relate to people. And finally, then I'm not sure how it relates to the things of the world, but anyway, I was kind of responsible for the whole world. It doesn't have so much of a thing component. Now that's how this striving deadens us in our life and our relationships. And when we stay at it, we continue to build those tensions and those energies, and it's hard to let go. And that's how we tie ourselves up physically and relationally and in relation to birth. Does that help see how that works? Okay? And it's so simple. One of my real concerns is when we think of sin and confession of sin, we think of, you know, have I done anything bad or naughty or something? It's so much more pervasive than that. And we need to take a look at ourselves and say, what is it I'm hanging on to, rather than really opening up to Christ? And when I'm trying to make it all happen, that I'm not letting myself be filled. I'm cutting off what God is trying to give me. And I believe what God is trying to give me is health and vitality and aliveness. And when I'm trying to make it all happen myself, I'm cutting that off. Now, think for a moment what kinds of messages you got from your parents. They may not fit any of these, but what did it seem like your parents would say, if only you do this, then you've got it made? Groups, people, is have someone stand behind you and say that phrase, whatever phrase might have come to your mind. Come on now, do this, or be right, or be nice, or be this, or be that.
Sure.
And often, if they say that phrase to you, you can feel your body go, mm-hmm. that whole tension is built in. Now,
where did you put that? My dad had this thing, like, he couldn't find something, and it was our fault. Where did you put that?
Where did you put that?
Yeah.
Where
it's
did
like,
you?
Not that you lost it. Where did you
if
put
something's
that?
Going wrong, you must have done something.
Because I'm still trying to be perfect.
Oh, really?
He needed to protect his own. I didn't do it.
Yeah?
I'm innocent.
That's the hardest part, is finding you can identify what you hear, and then hopefully you're not putting that on or something else because of that with your children, and that's why this is really important.
Being slow, always reminded that I was slow.
And so hurry up,
and
hurry up.
Everything needed to be quickly done, regimentally done.
Don't bother to think about it, just do what I tell you. Yeah, that's enough.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now that's a mental driver in your head. The answer for those, then, I believe, is really coming and hearing the gospel that God loves you and God Christ came for you to give you life, to really hear the gospel at a deep level. First, be in touch with our drivers, how we drive ourselves, and then raise the question, wait a minute, what do I fear is wrong with me? In what ways do I feel I'm enough? What am I afraid of losing? What am I hanging on to? And what does that mean about what I feared would happen if I lost it? And we need to kind of peel down to that fear and get in touch with that. Because in a sense, that's the starting of our confession. I'm afraid rather than trusting. And then discovering what it means to let go of what we're hanging on to physically, like the relaxation exercise is discovering what it means to let go physically. To give yourself some messages about for instance, transforming these drivers into allowers. Rather than be perfect, you say, hey, it's okay to make a mistake. If I just, you know, Martin Luther said, sin boldly. What he meant by that was, you know, you're not going to do it all perfectly, so get out there and live. Try to love and try to do the best you can, and you're going to make some mistakes. So get out there and do it. Just live. Hurry up, which was one of mine. I learned to enjoy the getting there. And it was a whole different feel for me. And what I discovered is that I can do things quickly and yet relax. Down here, the be responsible one that I experienced, what I discovered as an allower for me, rather than be responsible for the world, I discovered that I can be who I am and be responsive to people. That has a whole different feel. I let go. I say, here I am. Oh, I can respond to that. I can respond to that. I'm not able to respond to that. It's like, it's a whole different way of functioning. Now, letting go and letting ourselves move into a state of quiet is, I think, an important part of discovering what we're hanging on to. And that is done, I believe, in relaxation exercises and in meditation. And what has been found, I wanted to give you an idea from this book. Notice what he said. Beginning in 1978, Wallace researched the effects of meditation on human aging. He used three markers for biological aging as shorthand for the aging process as a whole: blood pressure, near-point vision, and hearing threshold, all of which typically decline as people grow older. He was able to show that all these markers improved with long-term practice of transcendental meditation, indicating that biological age was actually reversed. Meditators who had been practicing the TM technique regularly for fewer than 5 years had an average biological age 5 years younger than their chronological age. Those who had been meditating longer than 5 years had an average biological age 12 years younger than their chronological age. And then he goes on to explain the dynamics of what he sensed happens. Transcendental meditation is just one technique. It's a technique of letting ourselves focus our mind on one thing so that we begin to let go of all the things that we're hanging on to. I believe it's also possible and intended that as we focus on Christ in some way, letting Christ come in and having ways of doing that, letting the light of God come in, that we can let go of all that we're hanging on to. And that is so foreign to our culture. Our culture says we need to figure things out, we need to keep thinking about things, that we have not learned much about being receptive, letting ourselves quiet down, become still, become in a sense empty, so that we might be filled. And yet Jesus was emphasizing the importance of receiving the light, receive the Spirit, receive God's love. And so being at peace is one, discovering what we're hanging on to; two, letting go; and three, having regular times to move into a period of quiet in which we let go of everything, let ourselves be still, and begin to realize that when we are doing nothing, we are being filled, that we can be receptive at that point. And I'd love to have more time and experiment with that with you, but at least that's the framework that I come from.